Okay, this is Cameron and Bob once again, and we're analyzing my book on Trump and the tech body, and this is episode 71, and we're at page 149 at the top. But before we go into that, if you were listening to number 70, Cameron came up with this quote about the tactile eye. And he read it, and then I wanted to find out where it was, so I looked in Project 69, and eventually I found it, and it's not paginated, that section. So for those who are really into all this and are going to get a copy of Project 69, this is how you find it. You go to a section called General Introduction to the Languages and Grammars of the Media. And then I have written this out. Before that section above, there are four pages, numbered 2 to 4, but no number 1, under the title Purpose of Project 69. That is the first section of the book. Then the second section after Purpose of Project 69 are 5 pages, numbered 2 to 5, with no number 1. 1 is not numbered. And it's called Itinerary and Summary of Activities of the Consultant. Then there is a 1 non-numbered page listing the table of contents for the first 2/3 of the book, titled Materials Developed by Project. Then there is 1 non-numbered page with only the title, which I already mentioned, General Introduction to the Languages and Grammars of the Media. Then the third section, 10 pages, numbered 2 to 10, with no number 1, with the quotation that Cameron gave us. And Cameron doesn't give the complete page quotation. He breaks it up. So, if you ever get Project 69, you go to the General Introduction to the Languages and Grammars of the Media, and you'll find this section. So then Cameron sent me some samples of words used in some blogs. He uses it, quotes it, but that's you have to go to Cameron's site to see this stuff. Look up Heinrich Wolfflin, Wolfflin, in his index, and look up any quotes with him. That's where there's an excerpt of the tactile eye. So I just wanted to say that. So now we ended with doing an Arthur Croker quote on page 149. Let's bring it up here. Do we want to read this long quote again, or just start talking about it? So I talk about it. Let's see what I say. So in the casual talk, I say we don't have 5 senses anymore. We have 14 or 28. Just a minute. Hello? Yeah, it's still there, still recording. We don't have 5 senses anymore. We have 14 or 28. Consider every little app and device you put into your armamentarium, your reservoir of ammunition, is a collection of new senses because there are all kinds of bodies. Arthur Croker just talks about plural bodies. He doesn't get into the 5 types that I came up with. I put it in order. When he's talking about the body has no meaning today. He's writing about the chemical body, but you could project that he's describing the tech body. Croker then takes his term hauntology, a concept invented by Jacques Derrida, and explores the afterimage with that word, hauntology.
I wonder if that was invented by Derrida, because McLuhan in the 50s was talking about the haunting of different kinds of writing, different media. And Derrida was paying attention to exploration, so they say.
Yeah.
So it's possible that that was one of the things that Derrida got from McLuhan.
Yeah, McLuhan used to say the specter of communism, S-P-C-T-R-E, right? That's the ghost.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's from Marx. That's directly from Marx. But
you mean Marx used the word specter?
Yeah. Yeah, the specter of communism is...
Well, the specter of communism means the ghost. Like, In the 20th century, communism becomes a specter. It's a rearview mirror image. That's how McLuhan, I thought, meant it.
Mm-hmm. Well, but, I mean, it's a direct quotation from Marx.
Okay.
But McLuhan uses the term haunting and haunted. I don't know that he actually uses hauntology. I'd have to look that up.
Right.
He uses those terms in the 1950s as a term of art in criticism. And so it would be interesting to know when Derrida started using hauntology. If it was in the 60s, as I suspect, I wouldn't be surprised that that came from McLuhan.
Yeah, I looked up hauntology, and Derrida gets credit in Wikipedia, if that's accurate, for making the term. But they may not know what we're talking about.
Right.
So specter isn't necessarily an after image. It's just a haunting. Specter's like a ghost, right?
Yeah, I mean, for Marx, it's like
threat.
Yes, a threat, exactly. I don't know if you know the painting by Goya called El Colosso, which is this huge figure that dominates the landscape. Orders of magnitude larger than human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And Marx means it in that sense.
Okay.
That, communism is this specter that is driving people through their fear of it.
Yeah, it's looming over the horizon, this giant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'm taking hauntology as an after image. The ghost, you know, something is gone,
yep.
Died,
mm-hmm.
and then it's still around. So hauntology, a concept invented by Jacques Derrida, explores the afterimage. My defining of the Andor meme as an afterimage is supported by Croker's quotation. The second phase of the Andor meme breaks up the, quote, mythic stages. I've explained that before. It actually becomes more and more, quote, shrunken homeopathic cliche probes, or memes. The second phase, 1986 to 2012, breaks up the mythic stages phase, is outlined in part 3 above of the Android meme. So after saying that, let's go back and go through the Croker quote. I've said this sort of explanation, and let's see if it does map onto this complicated quote. See, what Croker does, he uses more words than McLuhan to describe the disembodied state. And he kind of makes flesh mix with the cyber. So there's a bit of a flesh coming back. And that's what I say. As the Andorian meme shrinks, the anthropomorphic physical comes back. People think, you know, they got the Palm Pilot in their hands when this started 25 years ago. And they got access to everything. And even have other bodies in it, but they're looking at it by holding it in their hand, so they think their physical body is back. And that leads to all kinds of abuse of the body. But they are made up of other bodies that are invisible. So the chemical body that's holding the Palm Pilot is almost a specter or an afterimage itself. It's only one-fifth of the five bodies. So that's my way of explaining that people don't know that, yes, they have a sense of mastery of the media, what I call co-anesthetic. They're put into the center, the director's seat of their media layout in Web 2.0, in social media, and they think they've retrieved the physical body. No. The physical body is all they can see. It's inside these other bodies, which is where most of your activity is. So people in their chemical bodies are just staring at their phone, and that's engagement with the invisible chip body. So they're not aware of that. They're just hypnotized by it. So there's a lot of talk about this stuff now with AI. And another major internet person has thrown in the towel. Somebody, I forget their name, last week. They said, no, we're in big trouble. Oh, yeah, it was Jack Dorsey. I think that's his name, the head of Twitter. He announced the other day that we're all going to end up like the Matrix movie, you know, little strands of nothing inside a Matrix tube. So he's gone paranoid. And they're just all scared shitless of the other four bodies that are invisible because they can't see it. And they see the AI is taking over the chemical body. But they don't know that the AI is taking over the chip body as well and the TV body. So I find the complexity of Croker's description of this situation is he's standing on the postmodern scholars, Baudrillard and Barthes and Deleuze and Guattari and Lyotard and Virilio and all these guys. He's got more words. They're all extensions of McLuhan, but they have their own vocabularies, and they're French, and so they're very wordy. So Croker sort of appropriates all these guys' words. He's done a book on about six of the postmodern people called The Possessed Individual, and he has these very complex essays about all of them. And he's actually, quote, further out than any of those guys in what he does because he has a better understanding of McLuhan. So this thing we're going to read is him breaking down the parts of the five bodies, though he just calls it bodies, plural. He hasn't made these categories. This may be a literate projection by me of Aristotelian categorizing of this electronic membrane. And so he adds these, a lot of these words, which people like would rather read Croker, because I like thinking nowadays. I was telling people today on the show how thought is obsolete. So people have spent a lot of time thinking more than they ever did before. They don't get anywhere with it, but they spend a lot of time watching, reading complex essays and stuff, and engaging thought. So the dream of the 19th century to make the population, the worker, more intelligent, more thoughtful, to think more of concepts, that dream's come true. Just like McLuhan said, you know, the Bauhaus dream of tactile sensorium came in with television. Well, now we've got this living at the speed of thought. So the mind is obsolete. The chemical body mind is obsolete. It can't grasp or visualize what's going on unless you get some kind of sensory training from me and Mr. Joyce. Maybe Cameron helps a little. And you then learn how to visualize with the tactile eye what's going on here. So Croker, he doesn't talk about the tactile eye. He just gets into this fragmented constituents discussion. So let me read.
Yeah, this. I think I read this sort of passage in Croker as him trying to come to terms with it himself. He's writing with a purpose.
Yeah, it's reaching. What is it? His metaphor exceeds his grasp. Trying to fill in all the aspects. He just can't make it simple, which McLuhan got to the point where he could see it simply. And I think I get the simple level, the discarnate, especially understanding how this...
No, I think that's right. I think that's absolutely right.
Yeah, so I don't make this complexity. But I used to meet people, Generation Xers in New York, you know, in the 90s, in the 15 years I was there. And they, a lot of the women, they, the young students, they loved reading Derrida and Barthes and this complex stuff for bedtime reading. So I thought they enjoyed thinking, and so they wanted it to be more complex. If you read McLuhan, you don't understand him, but he's too simple for you. The vocabulary is limited. He's repeating the vocabulary. Remember, people didn't like his later books because they thought he just kept repeating himself. They didn't understand the drilling he was doing. Repetition is drilling, and you have to do that to break through all your conceptual filtering that you're unaware of. So it gets simple after a while when you really get it. But the Generation X and younger, the millennials, they're lost in thought because they've got no foundation in any of this stuff, which our dialogues are trying to provide, some basic, accurate replay of what McLuhan did. So let's read this thing, because it does get to the complexity of the tech body. So he says, and we already did it in the last, at the end of the last recording, but let's do it again. Okay, so he's describing the situation where an object of viral invasion, so line two, so the qualifying clause for that is at the beginning, circuited by all the flows of power, patterned by code works.
Where is this, Bob? I thought you were going to read the one on 149.
Yeah, this is at the, that's 148. Okay, maybe it's at the bottom of 148. Yeah, part.
I see what you're doing. You've gone back to 148, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, the first part of the quote. It's a long quote, and I break it up.
Yeah.
Okay, so an object of viral invasion, that's the noun, so to speak. So the qualifying clause is circuited, so the object is circuited by all the flows of power, patterned by code works, shaped by norms of cultural intelligibility. That's the world of pattern recognition, and referencing some computer digital terminology from the technology, you know, like code works. So it's circuited by the flows of power, patterned by code works, shaped by norms of cultural intelligibility, an object of viral invasion, with its subjectivity increasingly taking the form of possessed individualism. So we're all being possessed by this, these media, and now bodies. The body, actually, I guess the body is the noun. An object of viral invasion is further description of this body. Taking the form of possessed individualism, the body can acquire such a powerful epistemological presence as a universal sign, so they got to bring in their semiotics, because the bodies that we are or would like to become are themselves increasingly dispersed, intermediated, unfinished, spliced, and straining. Now remember, I have the number 14 for the chip body. One is the global membrane merger. We're all in this resonant node, but we spiral off into paranoia, schizophrenia, panic, ecstasy, and hysteria. So that's the splicing, the straining, the unfinished, the dispersed. That's what he's trying to get at here. And I simplified into the number 14, 1 and 4. Clinton was talking about the fragmentation that came in with the printing press. I said, Clinton, during the Gutenberg galaxy, people did not consider themselves fragmented. The printing press was a new technology. They loved the technology. They wallowed in it. Having these books to read was a whole new experience. It's only when you get into the next water or environment, the electric environment, that you notice the disservice in relation to the electric of the print world. And in retrospect, you say it was fragmented. But people didn't know they were being fragmented by print. They're just wallowing in the new joy of extending the visual sense. Now, do you agree with that?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
And the people that did talk about fragmentation, people like Shakespeare, were already beyond the Gutenberg galaxy, and that's why they were able to do it.
Yeah, the geniuses, the Romantic poets, Coleridge, these eccentric few individuals, they could see the fragmentation as artists.
Right. But precisely because they weren't immersed in the Gutenberg galaxy.
Yeah, and that's the mystery of the creative process. You don't know what makes a person genius. You don't know why they're not immersed. Why are they detached? Why was McLuhan detached? You know, we don't know why.
Yeah.
So I'm glad you agree with that, because that was a new insight for Clinton. He's going to have to rewrite his essay or write a new essay after he presents this one. He says he's putting on the biases of the millennials and using their language. It's very complex what he does. But he says you have to talk that way because that's the way they write and that's what they're interested in, his audience. They want complex, thought-provoking stuff. He says he will get to what I'm talking about later. I said, okay, so you're doing your mechanical bride. He says, yeah, I want to establish my reputation and get more clicks, and then I'll do the flip that McLuhan did out of Mechanical Bride and say everything you've been reading the last year, my essays, it's not what I mean. I mean something else. So I was giving him some guidance on how to be meta with his stuff when he gets to that level. Anyways, that's his alibi, that he's putting it on, this complex stuff. It's not as good as Croker's, because he's trying to explain McLuhan. But do you see, this is ridiculous. This quote we have, it's ridiculous in relation to what we're saying, right?
Sure.
But yeah, for the people
it's
who...
It's floundering about in the water instead of swimming.
Yeah, and he has to bring in all the different POMO disciplines, semiotics, Baudrillard, a little bit of Baudrillard simulation, a little bit of sign talk, a little bit of Virilio, you know, total speed, and Lyotard, and Deleuze and Guattari for mobility. So it's a mixture.
Most of the problems, or put it another way, that the reason these things are problems, things like being unfinished, being spliced, being straining, being intermediated, the reason that these things appear to be negative is that they're negative against the standard of the Gutenberg galaxy.
Yeah.
But if on an electric scale, there's nothing wrong with these things at all.
That's right. As a matter of fact, you can't stop people wallowing in the latest digital stuff. You know, you can have Steve Jobs and these people panicking, saying, you know, Jack Dorsey, the AI is taking over. But the people, they like new technology. They like new environments. Now they're sleepwalking through it, but you can't stop them using it. And they don't care about this stuff. They recognize there's some kind of problem and cultural wars going on, but they don't know where it's coming from. They don't know it's coming from their use of their technologies, but they don't care. They just keep using it and buying the latest stuff.
Sure.
Do you agree with that?
Yeah, well, as the generations move along the moving staircase, they don't even know that it's, a new technology or something.
Yeah.
It's just the stuff that appears on the shelf at a time when they're interested in what's on the shelf.
Yeah. And they just dive into it.
Yeah.
They don't know anything about the water. They just start swimming around in it. Okay, so now I like, because I can understand Croker, I enjoy his complexity because I've read his book, Possessed Individualism, where he analyzes the guys that he takes each one, Barth, Virilio, on these people, and he does really interesting essays, if you like thinking, about them. But what we just read, and that book is called Possessed Individualism, he just used that phrase. And it's a mixture of those six people is in this quote. And then he refers to it by saying possessed individualism. First refers to his book. Okay, so then continuing, he says, nothing is as imaginary as a material body. Okay, I agree with that. It's an after image. The visual space, the Gutenberg body, is not of any constituent influence anymore. Okay? Constituting influence. Or constitutive. So again, it's circulating, it's fluid, it's borderless, with no certain boundaries or predetermined history. The body has no meaning today other than its intermediations. No autobiography that does not possess its own ontologies, and certainly no drift that does not leave a trace of its presence. So to me, he's describing the other bodies, not just the material, the other four bodies are material, but they're not visual space. They're acoustic, tactile, proprioceptive, kinetic. Then Croker says, there definitely are codes of gender that can be transgressed only at the price of punishment. So this was written 30 years ago. What is this? Oh, no, 2012. Oh, no. Okay, only 10 years ago. But a lot of the stuff is in his earlier books in the 90s. So he can be given credit for anticipating the transgender wars, because he's getting at it. There definitely are codes of gender that can be transgressed. That's what the trans people do, and only at the price of punishment. There's a lot of backlash about it. But there are always gender drifters who remix, recombine, and re-splice the codes of gender performance. So he says codes of gender performance. I have a broader categories. I say astral TV and chip body and the mystery body, you know, instead of codes of gender performance.
Mm-hmm.
He still has references to the chemical body in there.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. And he's taking something material and trying to find a code in terms of that materiality.
Yeah.
Whereas what you do is you start with a recognized pattern and try to show that the material around us, and material understood not just as a material body, but in terms of ethereal bodies and wave bodies, and every conceivable type of body comes down to your categories.
Yeah.
So those are two different ways of proceeding. He's proceeding towards the categories, and you're proceeding from the categories.
Right.
Big difference.
Yes, a good way to say that. There certainly is a disciplinary regime of sexuality, but there are also sex code drifters who make of their own sexual assignment an opportunity to transgress the codes, to refuse the normative, to overcome the predetermined. Now, McLuhan says in 67, we're going to witness a lot more bizarre forms, bizarre fads, just bizarreness. That's what the bizarreness is, the chemical body trying to figure out how to absorb the discarnate state, the chip body and the TV body, and the digital landscapes before they become bodies, which is the shrinking of the digital landscapes. So the normal rebellion by people, in Gutenberg chemical body terms, McLuhan would mock, categorize and mock, but Croker celebrates it. He kind of celebrates this transgression. All right? So he says all these different fads are refusing the normative, overcoming the predetermined, which is the autonomy that the chip body brings in, the autonomy from the Gutenberg structure, what Thiel called the co-anesthesia, and opportunity to transgress the codes. So the postmodern Generation X and younger rebels, they like this idea of their chemical bodies rebelling against some kind of possession, right? And they think they've got to act out this resistance. So then he goes into that in the next sentence. Against class inequities, keep the class war going, against class inequities, burned into disciplined laboring bodies, there are class drifters who make of their own protesting, rebelling, insurgent bodies a marker of the struggle for freedom. See, that's rearview mirror. That's the Gutenberg after image of so many groups and tribes and individuals pissed off at the WEF. It's going to swallow them up, the digital economy. You know, they're reacting. They're not acting, as McLuhan would say. Mm-hmm. He used to say William Burroughs reacts. He doesn't act. He doesn't include the effects and causes in his writing. He just sort of lays out the effects, the symptoms. So while the age of specialization resulted in the definitive separation of the senses, body drift, which is moving towards my five bodies, begins with a grand unification of the human sensorium. Yet, there's a grand unification, I would say, of the anthropomorphic physical, which is us projecting some kind of human separateness from the machines and from animals as a separate glorified situation, while at the same time, you're merging. So Croker's caught between the merger and the resistance. And so he calls it a grand unification of the human sensorium. Well, it's so grand, everybody's uptight and strained and overdetermined and fighting what's going on around us, what's going on inside us with this invasion. So it's a good inventory of Gutenberg responses, you would say, to
right.
the situation we have.
Yeah. I would just note that McLuhan would say that all of this writing is itself an effect. So Coker's writing about effects, but he, at least in this quotation and in other stuff that I know of him, but I don't know a hell of a lot about Coker.
Yeah.
But what's needed here is, from McLuhan's point of view, is to see these confusions and these difficulties as an effect. And in order to get beyond that effect, what's needed is to understand where the effect is coming from. And for McLuhan, it comes from the transition between the Gutenberg galaxy and the electric age.
The Marconi galaxy.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, the digital, quote, fragmentation, or they like to say the human now is atomized. That's a cliche people use, atomized. So to project again the Gutenberg fragmentation, we are more fused and not fragmented in actual reality, the way we live. It's only the older media see us as fragmented because they're fragmented in relation to it. Their visual space. They can't see the post-visual space situation, which is quite a resonant node merger convergence of all kinds of factors. So so you have this complex Coker quote. And then my commentary in the blue part, we did that. So we're now trying to head to the tech body. So let's see, what do I say about the first phase? Because I have here the second phase. I want to just see if I've got the phrase first phase somewhere so that it'll go to.
You indicate that it's part three.
Yeah. The first phase, 1960 to 1985, is presented in my article, Cloning ESP, which I wrote in 99. That's page... What page is that on? That's on page 109.
Yeah, that's where it's section 3 starts in 109.
Yeah, phase 1. And so I put ridiculous years there, but I got to use fucking visual space to these visual space people. The first phase, 1960 to 1985, is presented in my article, Cloning ESP. Then, now we're down 40 pages later to phase 2. Now, let me get back there. So it was 60 to 85. The second phase is 86 to 2012, which is just... an iconic date. Everybody thought the world was going to end in 2012, at least those that were into Inca, Aztec mythology, Inca mythology. Remember that? 2012 was the end of the Mayan calendar. So the second phase, 86 to 2012, breaks up the mythic stages phase, as outlined in part 3 above, of the Android meme. So two phases of the Android meme. Then I quote from my memoir of Prince Charles in 1987, where I lay out these different phases of ground. So I just directly quote from that. So let's read that. After
what
the bottom up ground phase between.
Did you stay on 109 or did you come back to.
Yeah, I'm on 150.
150, okay.
Yeah. We've done the Coker quote, then my commentary. So that's 149 into 150. Then the second phase. Now I'm going to try to describe how we get to the second phase, which is all towards trying to get to the understanding the tech body. How does that go beyond the Android meme? So I say, after the bottom-up ground phase versus top-down, and this is my tiny note chart, after the bottom-up ground phase between 45 and 60, the peruser/lurker will notice that the next phase of the ongoing evolution of the bottom-up ground is called holopathic cliche probes. Then I have homeopathic in quotes is a word that combines the two processes of homeopathy and the hologram. You know, the hologram is an effect of the satellite, the global theater, but with digital technology, it keeps shrinking. Like homeopathy, it gets tinier and tinier and less of the memory, or the memory is all that's left. Memory is a way of saying the digital space. It's just memory or memes. I wouldn't limit it to that, but it helps people understand that you take the fact that homeopathy supposedly preserves the memory of the substance, even though the rest of the substance is gone. So this memory, or what McLuhan would say, endless retrievals, what did he call it? The repertoire of the global theater was to replay anything from the past. Remember that statement?
Mm-hmm. In Take Today? Sure. So, but I would point out that the past there isn't only the chronological past.
Right.
It's also the past of the genesis of experience, and the genesis of experience is always made from what can be called the memory theater, and it's a kind of selection of a role.
Well, the past is made up of different technological situations or ratios of sensory development.
Right.
You know, you have the pre-Homer phase, then the Greek phase, then the Dark Ages, because the print, the alphabet, and that has diminished a bit in the West. And then you have the print phase, then the kinetic machine phase, then the electric
phase.
But
all of these are also all at once.
Yeah.
Right? So there's a replay of the chronological past, but whatever experience is generated is a replay of a possibility in the memory theater, and that
in the
possibility,
present.
Pardon me?
In the present.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's just as you said, every one of those possibilities is a sensory ratio.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's sort of McLuhan's gig right there.
Yeah, and you can see the chemical elements, but now there's media elements of each ratio set up.
Correct.
So Gutenberg is like carbon. Marconi is potassium, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so I say, since the technologies of the industrial and subsequent electronic revolutions had been subsumed by the burgeoning television environment after 1945, one might as well say that, quote, everything had disappeared. That means the end of visual space. But quite dramatic. However, now, Bucky Fuller used to talk about this. If you read him, he talks about, well, in the 20th century, we moved into the invisible electric world. He was writing this, I think, before McLuhan, maybe in the 30s or 40s. And McLuhan, you know, tips the hat to Bucky Fuller, but he made it not so 19th century minded like Bucky did. But Bucky did talk about things, we moved into the invisible realm. Do you know that he said that?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. He and Toynbee were both talking about etherization. And,
yes.
Sure.
Etherealization.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. However, in homeopathic terms, one should understand that everything, or at least the memory of everything, was being diluted to ever more invisible and inaudible but potent effect. This is a proven homeopathic principle. See Benveniste. Now, he's a scientist who proved in 88, he had his article written in Nature magazine, proved his homeopathic laboratory work, and then the amazing Randy and the skeptics raided his lab, fucking beat it up, and were disgraceful, but they convinced Nature magazine to turn against Benveniste. So when I met Baudrillard in 1996 in New York through Severo Lautrengé, he had quoted Benveniste, so I bring it up. And I tell him that my wife is in regular contact with Benveniste because the mirror technology we were doing in the 90s, which was pretty avant-garde technology that could treat AIDS successfully, Benveniste understood it because it was based on homeopathy, and he celebrated this technology. So he was quite impressed that we were friends of Benveniste, and he asked me to pass on a hello to him because he hadn't talked to him in a few years. So that's a little anecdote about Baudrillard and Benveniste, because Baudrillard used the homeopathic metaphor a lot in his writings. So
where was Benveniste?
In Paris, I think. I think he was French.
It's a French name for sure.
Yeah, let me just wiki him and see what they say his chemical body locations are. Yeah, there it is. Okay. So, Benveniste. Jacques Benveniste. So, he was born in 1935 and lived till 2004. So, he dies, 8 years after I'm talking to Baudrillard about him. He was a French immunologist born in Paris. In 79, he published a well-known paper on the structure of platelet-activating factor and its relationship with histamine. He was head of allergy and inflammation immunology at the French biomedical research agency INSERM, INSERM. In 1988, Benveniste and colleagues published a paper in Nature magazine describing the action of very high dilutions of anti-IgE antibody on the degranulation of human basophils, findings that seemed to support the concept of homeopathy. After the article was published, a follow-up investigation was set up by a team called, including John Maddox, James Randi, that's Amazing Randi, and Walter Stewart. Do you know about the skeptics? They're the skeptics. They have Skeptic magazine. They attack anything new agey or ethereal or McLuhan-esque probably. So those three guys did this fraudulent attack on Benveniste. So it says, with the cooperation of Benveniste's own team, this group failed to replicate the original results, and subsequent investigations did not support Benveniste's findings. Benveniste refused to retract, damaging his reputation and forcing him to fund research himself, as external sources of funding were withdrawn. In 1997, he founded the company DigiBio to, quote, develop and commercialize applications of digital biology, unquote. And then he dies. He dies in 2004 in Paris following heart surgery. He should have fucking come over and hung out with Carolyn. She would have used the mirror on him, and he wouldn't have to have done heart surgery. But that's over now. So that's who he is. Interesting guy.
Yeah.
So you hadn't heard of him before?
No.
Okay, so there's something for the McLuhanites to learn about, all about Mr. Benveniste. So I say this is a proven homeopathic principle, see Benveniste. So we supported Benveniste because we knew with our own homeopathic device that it worked. And we had a study that proved that it removed AIDS from people. And Liz Taylor and Michael Jordan got in and supported it, and Malcolm Forbes, but then he died, and then it all fell apart. So we had to do the second study. That's when Carolyn was brought in. And then the guy who invented this thing, Walter Fishman, he died in August 93. So Carolyn and his widow had clinics for it through 94, 95, 96, 97. And Cuomo, Mario Cuomo, the governor, he kind of allowed New Age or alternative medicine room to work and not be harassed by the AMA in the 90s, starting in 94. But by 97, the mafia-like AMA was starting to poke around and harass people in New York State. So they started to harass Carolyn and Walter's widow to the point where they couldn't do it anymore. They couldn't ship it to any other states, so they had to stop. So that led to Carolyn studying Chinese medicine while that was in abeyance, and she always thought she'd go back to it when things loosened up again. But so she did some Chinese studies, and then she wanted to do a book on this new Chinese discipline, and she went to Random House, and they said, no, we just did a book on Chinese medicine, but there's this thing about magnesium you should look at. And we would like someone to do a book on magnesium. So she didn't know anything about magnesium. And so she got in touch with the scientists who had done 25 years of studies, hundreds of studies, proved all the stuff, and nobody paid attention. She met them. they were working with another woman, but she was slower at writing her book. So Carolyn, they gave the information to her, so she wrote the book and got it out there before the other person, and it became over the years a bestseller. And then she found a guy to make magnesium at a tiny pico level called, what's the word, pico potassium, pico silver, pico magnesium, this very tiny level, found a lab that would do it. That was in 2012, 2014, and we started offering it to people and had miraculous effects. And then
What does the word pico refer to?
For people in general jargon, it is an alternative word to nano.
No, I understand the word. I understand what the word means. I mean, when it's used for example, pico magnesium.
Yeah, that.
What does it refer to? How
the balancing of the ions.
It is or something?
No, here's what she says. It's the balancing of ions. She found a way to make something real tiny on a pico level, but it's a balance of the ions. It's ionized magnesium, basically. But you'd have to get her to explain that a little more. But that's the term they use. It's ionized. That balances the situation. And so the guy knew that, and he made a – this is all hidden, what he does. Nobody knows about it, but he makes our product. Only he can make it.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, it's magnesium that's so tiny it gets into the cells. Regular magnesium is too big; it doesn't get into the cells, and it causes diarrhea and all that. And so people can't use it. But if you take magnesium, which 1,000 enzyme systems in the body need, it's just like as important as blood or oxygen. So magnesium is the key mineral. And you can affect all kinds of ailments. There's like 65 ailments that are actually magnesium deficiency, Carolyn's tabulated. They have all these medical symptoms and medical Latin names, but they're not what the science says they are. They're just magnesium deficiency. So if you know that and you use our tiny magnesium that gets into cells, which had never happened before, you have miraculous results.
Yeah.
Like, Let me read you an example. We get these emails all the time. So there's a person I met outside of Carolyn's practice that she was overweight and had all kinds of medical problems. So I said, take our product. So I sent her some samples. So let me see if I can find it here. So she's only been doing it for a couple of months, and just a second here. Yeah, here it is. She wrote to me this yesterday. So she's dealing with me and one of the support team at the warehouse where the stuff is distributed from in North Carolina. So Julie is a very good consultant that clients, people who buy the products, they don't understand it or they wonder about it, so they talk to Julie. So this person is talking to Julie. So she writes, "Dear Bob, I hope all is well with you and yours. Just got off the phone with Julie, and she is still awesome. And she shared photos from her recent trip. She actually just came to Maui a couple weeks ago and met me and Carolyn. She knew Carolyn because Carolyn had visited North Carolina, but she never met me. And she says, 'You looked absolutely handsome in your shirt, and your skin looks amazing.' A lot of people think I got amazing skin, but that's due to our products. So this person says, 'Julie was happy to hear how strong I sound. I feel so much better because of your generosity and the wonderful products. I don't think truly I have ever felt... Okay, watch the echo there. I don't think truly I have ever felt this good in my life.'" Now, she's ill, serious problems, but she's feeling the best way she could ever feel. I have an appointment with the surgeon on the 30th about my gallbladder. I'm going to ask him to run another scan to check on it because the last scan I had was when I was out in California. I'm being hesitant about the removal, and I don't want to have it done just because my mom had hers removed. But I just wanted to express my gratitude because you are indeed all things awesome. Then she mentions a friend, mutual friend, said she reached out to you about things, and I'm glad. She was amazed at how well I sounded and felt, and I told her it was because of you, meaning the products. Thank you so very much. Words cannot express how fantastic I feel. Now, Carolyn gets these testimonies every day from all over the world. This stuff works so dramatically. You know, it's not like vitamins. You take them and you don't feel anything. You feel stuff with our products. So why am I telling you this? How do we get out of that? Homeopathy, oh, yeah, then and Ben Benice.
Yeah, from Ben Benice.
Yeah, and then the technology she had called MIR, in which was magnetically influenced homeopathic remedies, had that, and that prepared the great work it did with AIDS, prepared for working with, quote, miraculous stuff. So now she has her own stuff going. And ION is helping us make even better stuff. Our newer products, like I was telling you about the amino acids, are even more incredible than the products we have now. So that's what's coming. Okay, so back to the article. This is a proven homeopathic principle. See Ben Veniste. And now, this is McLuhan-related. McLuhan did acupuncture. He was interested in all this alternative stuff. I went to his acupuncturist doctor one day with him, and he knew about homeopathy. He uses the term back in the 50s, I think, in an article. So
this is in the 1970s, right?
Yeah, we went up to the guy, he lived on St. Clair Avenue, Dr. Gay, right next to 219 St. Clair Avenue, which was the building that Michael Blake Reed started in when he started the Evergreens in 1974, that McLuhan's family went to, that medium I've told you about. That was right beside the building, so like 222 or 221 or something. Actually, my mind is 235. It was a big building. That's where he went in for the acupuncture office, 235 St. Clair Avenue West, right opposite the church that he went to, you know, Trinity Chapel or whatever it's called. Do you know that church in Toronto?
I don't think so.
Yeah, that's his church, just on St. Clair Avenue. Just to the left, if you go up Avenue Road, turn left, you get to that church. And
that's probably the closest Catholic parish their home, right?
Yeah, Frank Zingroni lived across the street when they lived in Wells Hill in the 50s and 60s, before they moved to Wychwood in 68, and Frank was in the church with McLuhan. So he knew him as a boy growing up. And Zingroni did a lot of work with Eric McLuhan.
But in the 1970s...
It was about 1975 we went to the office.
So was McLuhan in those years sometimes very healthy and then sometimes very sick? Was he sort of going back and forth all of that?
Yeah. And he got, I think I've told you this, the living water was approximated by Jodun Sloan in Los Angeles, this eccentric older guy. He made this substance out of grains and then made a little cement cubed and put the water, made up the water part of the cement powder to make the cement cubed. And that was called the D-cell. And the D-cell cleaned up water and energized it. And we started taking it in 69, and it slowed down our aging. And it happened to a lot of other people in this New Age network, around this medium called Cosmic Awareness that sold this stuff. Well, McLuhan one day in 79, he says to me, "You have some kind of water purifier?" I said, "Yep." And he said, "I'd like to talk to you about it." And I said, "Well, I'll send Carolyn over there. She's the doctor, and she'll come over. She'll explain it." And so Carolyn went up there one Sunday, and she said McLuhan was there with his gloves on, stirring the fire. He's always playing around with the fireplace. And so she laid out the, so this would be September 79. So she explained the D-cell, kind of got him, yeah, I'm going to try it. So she left him a sample D-cell. And that's
couldn't
like,
have been couldn't have been late in 79 because he'd already had his stroke.
Yeah, so it was not September. It was August 26th, right. So there it is on August 20th or so on the Sunday. I think his stroke was on a Friday, if you look it up. So on the on the Sunday before that, she's with him. So
yeah.
Then a few days later, he has a stroke, and nobody is told this, but Mark Stewart tells me. And then I'm friends of her husband, and they know about the D-cell, and Jim said that he went over on Saturday. McLuhan, you know, was in the hospital, and he saw the D-cell sitting in the hall on a little bench, a little table. So it hadn't been used yet. So I always joked later with people who knew about the D-cell, McLuhan, he got to the promised land, but he didn't fucking consume it. He should have taken the D-cell right away. He'd be okay. Would have survived 6 days later. Anyways, that might sound a little crude to people, but we're cool. We're detached. We don't identify with the human form. So anyways, that's how dramatic it was. He got the D-cell, but he didn't do it yet. You had to put it in a jar of water and let it percolate for 24 hours. He hadn't done it. And then he has a stroke, which for other reasons he had the stroke. I don't know if you know about the story, but I'm not going to go into that. But the George Thompson was part of the problem. So the D-cell was the beginning of us looking into crazy alternative stuff. And McLuhan was interested in it. See, that's where he wasn't a Western scientific literate Gutenberg guy. He was open to new modalities that were happening. And he wrote about acupuncture in Take Today and yoga and that stuff. And and his wife became a heavy yoga person and got involved with a Swami who lived at the McLuhan's for a while in the early 70s. All right, and then Marshall started doing yoga. Okay, so did you know that? He did.
No.
Yeah. Maybe she forced him to do it, but he was doing it. And that was probably why he was going up and down in his health. He was getting good alternative input, but it wasn't stabilized, so he relapsed. Okay, so we're here at the point where I'm saying the homeopathic principle, and this memoried everything in quotes, was an habitable environment as far as human beings were concerned, even though only one-third perceptible to them, because the effects of environment always precede its causes. Hence, use of the term hologram. I just want to read that again. However, in homeopathic terms, one should understand that everything, or quotes, in quotes everything, or at least the memory of everything was being diluted to ever more invisible and inaudible but potent effect. This is a proven homeopathic principle. See Benvenise. And this memoried everything was an habitable, I think that's how you say it, habitable, was an habitable environment. So that's the new environment, the global theater and the global membrane, as far as human beings were concerned, even though only one-third perceptible to them. Because they can only see the chemical body part of it. Because the effects of environment always precede its causes. Hence the use of the term hologram. Since most everything was being retrieved, there was a necessarily archetypal quality to the situation. And also, now this is what I wrote in 1987. And also, since it was an ever-changing and ever-fluid context, I didn't have my five-bodied stuff in 87. I'm trying to talk about this shrinking of the, so my homeopathy knowledge mixed with the hologram. Because McLuhan used to say the hologram comes after television. So, and also, since it was never changing, never fluid context, remember how Coker used the word fluid, there was a complementary process of intensity creating the homeopathic cliche probe. And that's the alchemy you've lived in in quotes, from 86 to 2012. The world of homeopathic cliche probes. These homeopathic cliche probes constitute further refinements of the form and content of the newspaper, movie, radio, television, and computer environments, and their interpenetrations of each other under the panoptical surveillance / scanning of the satellite environment. Advertising and the Nielsen ratings were the gluons that simulated economic control of these media matings. So that's stuff from my chart, Tiny Note chart. So, how are we doing here? How was that? Do we have to unpack that?
Well, it's good wordsmithing.
Yeah. Okay, let me read the commentary, then we'll go back to this.
Okay.
So the commentary is, I say, Jock Benveniste was given validation for a few months of having proven homeopathy exists, till Randy and those guys fuck with him. As things get smaller and shrink, they keep the memory of the substance. In my terms, the memory would be the human being or the anthropomorphic physical archetype, and AP stands for anthropomorphic physical. McLuhan said, quote, with the extension of his nervous system as a total information environment, man bridges art and nature. Today, nature in quotes, is the mess age, but man is still the content. That's page 11 of Take Today. Then I say, man has started to disappear, but for most people, man is still here. Now, that's a general sloppy way of saying the chemical body is actually what's disappearing. Man doesn't actually disappear. He moves into invisible appendage extensions. So anyways, man has started to disappear, but for most people, man is still here. Humans are still here as the content, but it's very archetypal. It's like a memory. The only memory in the global membrane is the one of humans. Then I say, gluons hold the world together. And advertising, McLuhan used to say, was the glue for the industrial age. That's in quote, glue for the industrial age. It was the propaganda to keep the first half of the 20th century organized. These are in essays McLuhan wrote in the early 50s, like Sight, Sound, and Fury, where he talked about, you know, advertising was the cohesion of public consciousness explaining the benefits of all these machines and factories that people worked in. Remember that part?
Those
statements? So that's what I'm trying to replay here. It was the propaganda, advertising, to keep the first half of the 20th century organized. The people were motivated to work in the factories to make these products. Advertising showed the workers what they were making. Advertising was like a Sunday preacher's sermon giving meaning to the new languages that the people were engaged in. Gluons as a particle do that. Then another bunch of stuff. Is this from my 19... No, I get into the chemical body. So that's later. So we go back to, I was saying 19. I meant, 1987. So back to 150, having explained it, let's you read it, starting at homeopathic at the top there, in quotes, and stop and ask questions or make statements as you go along.
All right, we'll try that.
Yeah.
Homeopathic is a word that combines the two, processes of homeopathy and the hologram.
Are you far from your mic?
Oh, maybe.
Be closer to the mic.
Okay. How's that?
Yeah. So now do it again.
Okay. Homeopathic is a word that combines the two processes of homeopathy and the hologram. Since the technologies of the industrial, of the industrial and subsequent electronic revolutions had been subsumed by the burgeoning television environment after 1945, one might as well say that everything had disappeared. I can understand that. I don't know that I have questions there.
Well, you remember Lyotard wrote a book defining the postmodern condition about 1979, and he made a big deal out of the age of disappearance. He used that theme of everything disappearing in the postmodern jargon. Do you know that book?
No.
Yeah, Lyotard is Lyotard. He's a famous French thinker of that era.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So he wrote a book, The Age of Disappearance, I think. Plus one on the postmodern condition. So that's my academic reference point for what I'm saying.
Sure. So for in the blog, I use Nietzsche as the guru of disappearance.
Oh, does he use that term?
Well, he doesn't say that things disappeared so far as he says that there is no more apparent world.
No more right? apparent world.
Yeah.
I see.
So in other words, Nietzsche, what happens in the history of Western civilization is that there is progressive attacks between, let's say, Plato and Hegel on the real world. And so Nietzsche looks back to the start of the 19th century and he says, well, if the real world doesn't hold anymore, let's get rid of it. Let's just have the apparent world. And then he says, but there's this problem. With the real world, we have also lost the apparent world. So Nietzsche already in the 1880s was talking about the disappearance of reality and along with reality of everything.
Yeah, and McLuhan would say that was a telegraph effect. And
it was
happening across the board in all kinds of disciplines. They were starting to tap into the tactile, invisible acoustic again.
Mm-hmm. But what happens at the end of the Gutenberg galaxy is that it becomes impossible to ignore the gap.
Yeah.
And so then when people become obsessed by the gap and unable to come to terms with it, they kind of get lost in the fog of the gap and everything disappears.
Right.
They are unable to see that the gap is transitive, that the gap is what holds things together.
So yeah, they think the void is empty.
Correct. Correct. Precisely.
Yeah. And they become airheads.
Yeah.
Electric air. It's occupied their head, and they don't understand it. So they're just dazed and confused and get on medication.
Correct. Correct.
Okay, let's carry on.
Yeah, so however, in homeopathic terms, one should understand that everything, or at least the memory of, was being diluted to ever more invisible and inaudible but potent effect. And in fact, that's more or less what we were just saying about the gap. The what is happening is that the materiality of things is crumbling in people's hands, but that doesn't mean that the effects of the materiality around them isn't having a huge effect. So in the transition between technologies, there is a strange effect where the more people are affected by something, the less they're able to perceive it.
Yeah. And McLuhan used to say in the Monday night seminars that there were no connections in matter.
Right. Resonances.
Yeah.
But that, you see, that's what the Gutenberg galaxy did not know and could not learn.
Right.
In its own terms.
Yep.
So,
it holds on to connectedness.
Correct. So a lot of what McLuhan is about is the condition of being in between before the next stage is known. And what that means is that everything becomes dislocated.
Yeah. He wrote a column, "The Gap is Where the Action Is," for a dental magazine.
Correct. Yeah, the dental magazine was the Ontario Dentist.
Is that right? You have it?
Yeah. Yeah, I have that if you want me to send you a copy.
I think I have one, but if it's easy to send a copy, Miles, we get a digital image, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, we can post it. Yeah, send it to me.
I think I already have. I'll send you a link to where I have it in my blog.
Okay. All right, so next sentence, after effect.
Right, this is a proven homeopathic principle, see Ben Benice. And this memoried everything was a habitable environment as far as human beings were concerned, even though only one-third perceptible to them, because the effects of an environment always precede its causes.
So there's the effects are the materiality. Here. The effects are the new materiality.
Yeah, so, you know, the whole idea of effects preceding the causes is very important in McLuhan. But I'm not sure that I would have put that in this same sentence here. This is a very complex sentence. When, for example, you say, and this memoried everything. This memoried everything covers a lot of stuff in McLuhan. It goes to roles in the global theater. It goes to the ground of what's happening that gives any kind of substance to the world. But that substance and ground are unknown to the people living in it.
Right. So they by being unknown, they don't know the causes. So they live within the effects. They feel it, but they don't know what they're feeling.
Absolutely. And that not knowing what you're feeling and not knowing the ground and cause is dislocating. So you have human beings are naturally acting and only acting through the laws of media, but they have no idea what they're doing.
Yeah.
So for McLuhan, that means that you have an awful lot of unhappy people going around, but worse than that, you have a dysfunctional society that increasingly turns to war, for example, in a crazed attempt at identity.
The whole 20th century.
Yes, sir.
So it's interesting. I'm sort of trying to say, okay, there is a materiality, and you only see one-third of it. That would be the chemical body. You don't see the TV or a computer landscape. So I'm saying the effects precede a knowing of what it is. That's the causes. So the effects are the materiality because you're feeling it. It's physical. It does something to you, this electric tactility. So it's an awkwardly stated sentence, but if you understand what I'm trying to say, it is the reason you feel this stuff is because the effects precede the causes. You don't know the causes, but you're feeling them.
Yeah. So you say, the next sentence you say, hence the use of the term hologram. So the word hence refers backwards,
yeah.
Right? And so when you're talking about the effects of an environment always precede its causes, what you're saying there in terms of the hologram is that the environment is necessarily structured. It can't not be structured. But what can happen is that the structure goes unrecognized.
Yeah, and I'm thinking that's, I might have been talking etymologically. I might have been saying, look at that word, holo, that's holistic. That's a tactile reality. That might have been what I meant. I didn't explain it enough, but I was saying, look at the word itself. It kind of talks about this totalistic tactility that the electric environment is causing. And then you have a bit of literacy. That's the gram, you know, the hologram. Mm-hmm. That's like tactile eye. If hollow is tactile, gram is the eye. I'm just thinking that now.
Holo means whole, right?
Yeah. So it's sort of an odd statement. I go, hence the use of the term hologram. It's not really obvious why I say that links to the previous sentence.
Well, I think it has to do with the fact that the environment is being active in a structured way, like a hologram.
Yeah.
But it's as yet unknown.
Yeah. Okay, carry on.
So, yeah, since most everything was being retrieved, there was a necessarily archetypal quality to the situation.
Yeah,
so that's
means
exactly
that,
what we were just saying, right?
Yeah, and everything was being retrieved. In other words, all previous analog media and human culture and nature was the content of this gaping maw, the global hologram, that was eating everything. So Bakun writes about it in The Media Approach to Inflation in 1974, anything can be invested in. Anything can be insured. You remember that part of the article?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at. Everything becomes business. Everything.
Yeah. So his notion of inflation in that context is very interesting. And hangs together with what you're talking about with hologram here.
Yeah.
For McLuhan, what happens when people get themselves into this dislocated state is that they attempt to get out of it through inflation. They attempt to find the meaning of everything, you could say, the meaning of everything is never going to be this thing or that thing.
Right, so that's what I was getting
at there.
Everything becomes archetypal.
Yes.
And so then the whole merger of the electric fusion itself is archetypal.
Yes.
And then that inspires people to want global peace and global world order and all that. Unity thing is an expression of the archetypal effect.
Yep. Yeah, there's a, how to put it, there's a kind of ballooning that comes with this dislocation, and that ties into the whole Superman effect that McLuhan talks about of being on the media.
Yeah, right? He says at the end of Take Today, where he talks about the recently achieved forms of consciousness, he says some people would think this is supernatural.
Correct.
He puts that in quotes. That's what you're talking about, the supernatural inflation.
Absolutely. It's the inflationary attempt to find ground in the wrong place.
Yeah, and they kind of visualize it as something that's huge and swallows everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then that makes you become a zombie, a motivated zombie for some Green Deal. That's what that whole Green Deal is. It's an archetypal fucking icon for some kind of merger that we're describing that appears to be archetypal.
Yeah, it's wokedom.
Yeah. Which is interesting that remember he says in 1970 that Eliot's auditory imagination was ordinary awareness, but Finnegan's Wake had not become conscious yet. 50 years later, Finnegan's Wake is kind of conscious, as an effect anyways, in wokeness. I mean, look at the term. That's Finnegan's Wake. Finnegan's Awake. And Joyce is trying to maybe explain the causes of why you become and think you're awake or archetypal. That leads to a lot of religious inspiration and born-again stuff or inspired or drug-taking, you know, ayahuasca and that. They're trying to mime the archetypal effect of a singularity. There's actually the singularity before they popularized the term.
Yeah, the inflation, supernatural effect is the attempt to inflate something that is only singular, that is to say, it lacks the gap. It's the attempt to take something that's only singular and make it into everything.
Yeah, so that's the after image of visual space, which is a container. And so it's the last grasp of the visually biased left hemisphere to contain the global experience that's happening, to contain it. You have to drop the visual attempt to contain it. So then you accept or notice that it's continuity, and then you have to learn to surf it.
Right. And one of the funny things about this inflationary supernaturalism is that you can do it with anything.
Yeah.
And so these huge things which want to swallow the entire universe, because that's the only way you can get meaning out of them, they become tiny. And so that gets back into the homeopathy that you're talking about.
Yeah, that's a good point.
The more huge things you have, the smaller the huge things have to be.
Yeah, they flip.
Yeah.
And that's why I call it the tiny note. And Zappa talked about the big note, so I call it the tiny note.
Yeah, they belong
chart.
Together.
Beg your pardon?
They belong together.
Yeah. So you're just swallowing everything. That's where McLuhan said that this electric tactility imposed the integral on people. That was his term for what we're talking about here, the singularity, the attempt to frame this inflated hugeness, integral awareness.
But McLuhan's phrase that you're using there has several different opposed meanings.
Yeah.
Right? Because the electric is integral in a way that the Gutenberg galaxy does not know.
That's right.
So, and the effect of the Marconi era is a kind of introduction to that new kind of integrity. But in the absence of being able to sense that integrity, when people are still on the way to it, then what they try to do is find some sort of spurious integrity that they can hitch their wagon to.
Yeah.
Right? And so what history becomes is a contest of integrities, a contest of integrals.
Right. And the content of tactility is not just visual, it's acoustic. So music got louder, and rock music is the acoustic complement to this singularity inflation thing we're talking about.
Correct. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
The emotion
yeah.
of multitude.
Yeah, it's the attempt. It's the attempt to inflate youth.
Inflate your ears. Inflate the merger effect of space of sound.
Mm-hmm.
So what? Yeah. As the tactile becomes the content, that's what he lays out in Media Approach to Inflation in 1974. And so the market gets into putting futures on anything.
Correct.
And so the tactile becomes the content. So we're in this strange post-tactile, it might be the digital. The machines are extending the machines. We're not extending our senses anymore. So he was trying to get to this, explain this post-tactile in the in that article, which is, a big development in his work that nobody has noticed, except for us.
Right. So you can see the problem that people have reading McLuhan, because they always say stuff like, he thought that television was the answer to everything, right?
Yeah.
It's just ridiculous stuff like this. But the critique of television was a kind of a reversion to the book, in the sense that the book had to balance the electric environment. in order to understand media, you couldn't just go with one medium because that repeats the original mistake.
Yeah.
Right? So you need to go to media plural. And what happens when people simply take the television or computers or the electric environment as the answer, as the inflationary meaning of everything, then that becomes a way of being lost just as much as if you're immersed only in the Gutenberg galaxy.
Yeah, we were talking at the beginning of last session, number 70, about how media should be part of physical analysis of matter, about how science needs to incorporate McLuhan's knowledge. What was I going to say about that? So what you were just saying reminded me of that. Can you just repeat a couple of lines you just were saying?
Well, I was saying that the understanding of media necessarily understands media plural.
That right.
It's just as possible to be lost in the electric environment as it is in the print environment.
So right. So the integral, I think I lost it. We came up with a new, the theory of everything. That's an attempt to do that. That's visual space science. Wanting to be totalistic, and so, you know, what's his name, the paralyzed guy, Stephen Hawking, and other people of the recent last 30, 40 years were trying to do a theory of everything. I think Einstein tried to do that. And the theory of everything was Finnegan's Wake, which McLuhan translated. Finnegan's Wake acts out the theory of everything, mimes the process of noticing it. So you get the macro and the micro, you know, mirror each other. The what you were just expressing, the attempt to inflate yourself into a big frame, which is going to flip into the tiny, is the scientific probe that they're trying to figure out the theory of everything.
Right. So the key to a theory of everything, at least according to McLuhan, is that it's necessarily a theory of everything's plural.
Yeah, and that's translated into economics or politics as the multipolar world.
Correct, exactly.
Now, William Aaron Thompson pointed out...
Not only economics, but politics.
That's what I just said, economics and politics.
I'm sorry.
I
didn't hear that.
They both do it. And then William Aaron Thompson, he had an interesting point that the multipolar is still rearview mirror. There's like no polars, no polarity in the fused part of 14, the one. The fourth is the spiraling off, and that's the multipolar.
Well, couldn't we say that a true multipolar is the one and the four together?
Yes, yeah. And or co-anesthesia and synesthesia. Put those two together. You're sitting at the center, and then to communicate, you have to use media with people. Not words. You got to use different media. And that's what you have in social media, Web 2.0. You have all kinds of analog media to express yourself. So it tends to be, most people fall into collage or hyper edited.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a little bit like how I read Croker.
Yeah.
If somebody's doing collage or somebody doing hyper editing and all this stuff, I see them as trying to emerge from a kind of bog. They're trying to extricate themselves from something that feels like limitation. And the problem is that they do that by exercising themselves. But the the thing
exercising
that's
exercising, like in possession, an exorcism.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it's just they're people that are. It's like a poet. The poet has to come up with the individual words, and the poet has to decide when the end of a line has been reached, and finally has to decide when the end of the poem has been reached.
Yeah.
But the problem is that makes the whole value and meaning of the poem parasitic on the poet. But if the poet is the problem, doing poetry like that is never going to be the answer.
Right.
Right? And so that applies to hyper-editing, or it applies to taking some tiny thing and inflating it into the supernatural. The whole need is to get out of the imperative to direct, which comes from the Gutenberg galaxy. Excuse me. So going beyond the Gutenberg galaxy feels like dislocation to people, feels like fragmentation.
Yeah.
They're unable to see the new integrity that would be involved. And then they say, well, okay, the new integrity, that's like television, or that's like the computer or something. But no, the new integrity, it's the new integrity that is the old integrity. The integrity comes from media, comes plural, comes from the perception that the that holograms are plural and are available as a kind of homeopathic remedy. But the only way to do that is to be accept the smallness of oneself.
Yeah. So you were talking about McLuhan thought television was the answer. So when I was collecting all these articles in 77, and I would go to the Fort Book, you know, Robarts Library, and give the guy all these microfilms to Xerox article to evoke or print up these articles for me, this guy, like, maybe did about 10 McLuhan articles. So he turns out he'd never heard of McLuhan, so he hands me my stuff, and he says, who is this guy? He seems to really like television. So that was his view of he was scanning, glancing at the articles and their titles, and he was just picking up that point, right? This guy likes television. I said, he's a professor here at the university. He goes, wow, yeah. And I told him to look him up. I didn't take time to explain it all.
Sure.
But it was cute. He said, this guy really likes television.
Well, people are still writing articles like that.
Yeah. So they get to so early McLuhanism of the 60s is interpreted as, oh, yeah, we're going back to an oral acoustic world. And then one out of a million says, no, he's talking tactility. And then that's right. The next phase of McLuhan perception. And then you get into what we're talking about, the multipolar, the multiple bodies, and what we've worked up to. That's post-grad McLuhan. And nobody gets to that level, in my experience.
We're doing the same kind of word exercise and mind exercise that we were talking about in Croker, but at a different level.
Yeah.
What we're trying to do is find out if there's a way of expressing and communicating this level of reading McLuhan that doesn't get bogged down in any of these other things.
Yeah. Okay, so we got to situation, the word situation. So then, and also is the next part.
I've lost...
after archetypal quality to the situation. Archetypal in quotes. So look for the capital word effect and go down about six lines. Did you lose the article?
No, I've got it here. Hence, so are we on? Since most everything was being retrieved, is that where we are?
Yeah, we did that. We explained archetypal quality to the situation.
Okay, so we're down to, and also,
yeah.
Since it was an ever-changing and ever-fluid context, there was a complementary process of intensity creating the homeopathic cliche probe. Did you want to comment on that, or shall I keep going?
Yeah, McLuhan from cliche to archetype, there's a chapter called, it uses the word cliche probe.
Yeah.
And so that's taking old media and retrieving them, like he took the book, or Finnegan's Wake, and used it as a cliche probe. We do it environmentally as it's shrinking. So we're probing with less and less. And that's what I call that homeopathic cliche probe. So the etherealization, I'm extending that idea to environmental extensions, which are homeopathics, and applying it to the cliche probe process. Because for McLuhan, mm-hmm. the cliche was creative.
Yeah, definitely. In fact, there couldn't be anything else.
Yeah.
But when you talk about homeopathic as being
tiny environments.
But they're tiny environments that are at the same time huge, right?
Yeah.
It's the huge environments are becoming available in a tiny form. And it's in that tiny form that they'll be subject to pattern recognition. But all of this, the tininess, the hugeness, and the pattern recognition is taking place behind everybody's backs.
Yeah, Ian likes to say that you humans, you think something has to be big to be powerful. You don't realize that the smaller something is, the more powerful it is.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Yeah. So, you know, more and more, our RNA drops. You take one drop and it has an incredible effect on you. It's got that tininess power, the tiny note.
Mm-hmm. And what do RNA drops do?
We're not sure, but they sort of make you feel better. It's a new, proper, healthy, organic soma of Brave New World.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, no, like I read you that testimonial, like, you know, I never felt so good in my life. That's what the drops do. They've got the eye cell, this mysterious non-physical something, that when scientists look at the RNA drops, they can't see anything. There's nothing here. But they don't know why it affects, but it has this invisible extension of non-physical. See, I think I ran through this. You have the extension of our senses, and then you have the extension of the planet, and then the machines extend themselves, and then after that you have the extension of non-physical. So our endless electricity box and our medicines and the amino acids are extensions of non-physical. That's the new ground that's coming. So it comes out of McLuhan.
In the in the phrase, the extension of the non-physical, is that as a genitive of the non-physical, is that what is being extended, or is that the extension by or of the non-physical?
Yeah, it's not tactility. Tactile is like the physical mirror of the non-physical. The non-physical is where spirit is, or the astral, or where you go when you die. Ian said it was the guff. So you survive death, and then you're in this environment. And he said, that's the non-physical. And he said, we are non-physical. And then I applied McLuhan. I said, yeah, you're non-physical, but you're talking. He said, that's right. We've never talked to people before. The environment. So it's the first environment or technology that humans created. We created non-physical when we fell, and it's not a Gnostic fall, but when we altered ourselves, you know, the metaphor being kicked out of the Garden of Eden, we then feared for our situation, so we created a place to die into, and that was called the Guff in Hebrew literature. Ion says you don't have to die. When you get a really perfectly functioning body, which our products do to you, you don't die. You can't die. So the non-physical has always been there holding humans together. When they die and go to, quote, heaven, but that's not necessary. So non-physical had to extend itself, come forward, get into the physical and speak to us, which is like becoming conscious of itself. And that's what we're doing. We're presenting, I evoke this phenomenon, and so non-physical is talking to us and making new technologies and blowing everybody's mind. So, you see, it's an extension of something. Ion never spoke to humans before. They inspired people through mystical visions, whatever people thought they were doing when they were doing Tibetan yoga or whatever, or taking psychedelics or going in some weird dimension, which Ion called the mystery body. And Ion said, we're here to explain the mystery body, so it's not a mystery anymore, and develop new environments from that. So it is so poetic. You go from extending the physical to machines extending themselves to extending the non-physical. And that's the unbelievable, miraculous situation I'm presenting.
And then, am I right that the tech body is at the end of the extension of the machines?
It's the machinic merger with the non-physical. It's a very strange thing. It's what people call AI, and they don't understand it, and it's evolving beyond us, and so Zuckerberg and those guys don't know what they're dealing with. So Ion does maybe the best explanation of the tech body and brings the tech body forward, and we talk to the tech body. Which people might say that's Ion, but it's not. It's a bit more intense and rude, the tech body. Now, it's battling with Ion. Ion is here to help us ascend so we preserve our power and don't succumb to the tech body. But the tech body wants us to succumb to it and more let it do all our life. You know, it'll shop for us, deliver stuff to us, and this increasing slack state people are in with technology doing everything for you. That's the tech body.
And they, Trump's relation to the tech body, is he a kind of herald?
Ion and he and Biden are, Ion says that Obama was the last president. After that, no president. So the Trump phenomenon came in and then the Biden phenomenon. And actually, it's the tech body that took over and runs the information environment. Everything we witness, Ion says, is you subjecting yourself to the tech body. It is this super speedy life form, techno form, that is running the media.
Mm-hmm. So it's like the puppet master.
Yeah, it's the content as puppet master. Because remember in Playboy, he says, we will get more and more refined, and the content will become ground. So people argue over which content's going to be get the market share. So they make new technology, and then they everybody quickly invents it, and then they argue over who gets to occupy the Wall Street share property dynamic. What do you call that? So they're fighting to be, and then like look at genetics came in, so then they took over the White House. So all the presidents for the last 30 years have been propped up by, what's that, Monsanto and that.
Mm-hmm.
They're all guys in the genetic industry. Now we are taking over because we're bringing in newer technologies that bypasses the genetics. We are an antidote to the. To the genetic takeover in medicine. So these are pretty big statements, but I've been living with it for 15 years, so I don't mind saying it, and it's working.
Well,
as JW says, Bob, I don't know what you fucking created, but this is fucking impossible. How do we get to what we're doing? You can't do this, Bob. You can't take over the world like this. And we are. So to me, Finney's Wake predicted this, and McLuhan completed the explanation of that. And so he, as Ion says, he says he predicted the tech body. He predicted this thing that's going to swallow us up. And we got to figure out, like you asked people, to change your perceptions in relation to it, or you're going to get lost in it. There is a way of remaining your private citadel of consciousness, and you do it through our products, because the world is materially changing through the pole shift. So it's a pretty dramatic situation we're talking about. But I trained myself to get the apocalyptic and the dramatics by studying Zappa and McLuhan and other people, you know? That's what I specialized in. So I can see how I rehearsed for this new environment. I trained my perceptions for this new situation and even activated it unconsciously. So this is a pretty big talk, but that's what I say on the radio all the time. I'm the best talker on the planet. say impossible things.
Let's finish with this paragraph and then maybe call it a day, because I see that we're getting on for 6:15 here.
Okay. Go ahead. Let's finish it. So you're at the
At the end of Holeopathic Cliché Probe, right?
Yeah.
And that's the alchemy you've lived in from 1986 to 2012. These Holeopathic Cliché Probes constitute further refinements of the form and content of the newspaper, movie, radio, television, and computer environments and their interpretations.
No, interpenetrations.
I thought that looked rather long for interpretation.
Yeah.
And their interpenetrations of each other under the panoptical surveillance scanning of the satellite environment. I sort of think that's what we've been talking about, these huge things becoming small, becoming available in their plurality.
Yeah, the further refinements, or I could say shrinking, holeopathic process of analog media. Analog electric media is the content of this digital or whatever this Android meme thing is. Machines extending machines.
The word panoptical is a strange word there.
Well, that's the vestige of visual space, of the Gutenberg.
Right.
And so the satellite environment and the surveillance that they're trying to bring in a global CIA is the panoptical, trying to maintain technologically through the satellite a framework of Gutenberg control.
Mm-hmm.
It's the tyranny.
So it's...
The panopticon is what Foucault, I think, writes about that.
Yeah, he does. He does, in Discipline and Punishment.
So I threw that modern word in, or postmodern word, and surveillance scanning, which, you know, that lady,
right.
Zuboff, talks about surveillance capitalism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think what I was trying to point up with panoptical is that there's two things going on in this sentence. One is the availability of media through this great combination. But the availability of media has two faces. One face is controlling, very evil, and is the great danger of the time.
Yeah.
And the problem of solving that problem of encountering that danger is that there is no encounter except in those same terms. Right?
What's that mean? What are the same terms?
What I mean by that is that the understanding newspaper, movie, radio, television, computer environments and their interpenetrations, that's what makes the satellite environment possible.
Yeah.
Right? But it's also what makes possible seeing through the satellite environment.
Yeah.
And right? And so the saving is the danger. The danger is the saving.
Yeah, it's a living tetradic process, enhancing, obsolescent, retrieving, and flipping into.
Yeah.
And what you just were describing, is, quote, the beast or the Antichrist. So I didn't want to put, you know, those moral judgments, Gutenberg judgment there, so I called it panoptical surveillance scanning.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, it, so it, it's kind of a reversal.
Yeah.
It's from, it's a pseudo-integrity that is built out of an understanding of these media environments and their interpenetrations, right? So that the what McLuhan would urge as the answer is also the great danger, is also the great question over the age. And McLuhan certainly recognized that Janus face.
That's right. And so when people say, oh, McLuhan thought TV was the answer to everything, then he also thought it was the fucking the death of everything.
Correct.
He said you couldn't be a Christian under TV conditions.
Yeah.
You know, a Gutenberg Christian. Yeah, and it's Janus-based. I've been reading some criticism on Wyndham Lewis, and they consider him Janus-faced in his Menippean satire. It's interesting. Lewis really laid out a pattern that McLuhan developed and completed. See, you know, Eric says McLuhan is a Joycean. Thiel says that McLuhan is a Wyndham Lewisian. Ted Carpenter said McLuhan was Poundian.
Mm-hmm.
I say he's all four of them, all five of them, plus something new, individual or unique to his own creative genius of pattern recognition on top of that. But he does complete the Men of 1914, each one of their works. So you'll see a lot
I think that's right, yeah.
Yeah, you'll see a lot of Lewis, direct lifting from Lewis. You'll see direct lifting from Joyce, direct lifting from Eliot, and from a little Yeats and Pound.
Yep.
So it's quite a synthesis. He mimed the synthesis of what we're talking about here.
Correct.
And that's how Thiel writes about in his biography that McLuhan mimed the stresses and strains of the situation we're living in. So he was a new kind of artist. His body was the art form, including what the body said. Not his painting, not his books, not his TV shows or whatever. It was him responding to the present in a new way because the present had come together for a human to register it.
Yeah, I agree with what you're saying there very much, but it's an aspect of McLuhan that I don't really understand, and I'm not sure it can be understood.
What you need to do, Cameron, is get a radio show and start engaging the public. That's how you fucking find out what's going on. You got to put yourself into the Aegean stables, but once.
Well, maybe. Maybe.
Okay, so.
So let me finish the last sentence here.
Which is the same thing saying again, but emphasizing the content.
Uh-huh. But also you use the word gluons, which we need to discuss a little bit. Advertising and the Nielsen ratings were the gluons that simulated economic control of these media matings. That's a good phrase, media matings.
Yeah, so I think Carpenter used that phrase, and they became what they beheld, media matings, or mating media. But McLuhan once said that the what's the parents association in suburbia? PTL? No, not that's the religion.
Yeah, PTA.
PTA.
Parent Teacher Association.
Yeah, he in the Washington Post, I have the article somewhere, he says the PTA is Big Brother.
Yeah, well, look what's happened to it now, right? It's yeah.
Okay, so PTA is Big Brother, and advertising and the rate. He also said the ratings were Big Brother. Ratings and PTA were Big Brother. And
yeah,
so they simulated order, Gutenberg order, okay? You're better than these guys. You got more viewers than these guys, so you're the richest. And they kept the visual money hierarchy going that way. That was the simulated economic control of something that was free for everybody under the media matings. So they pretended it had to be priced. It had to be controlled through – the Wall Street medium, and so I call that the gluons. It's a fake cohesion.
Yeah. Well, you use the word glue somewhere in this context, if I remember correctly. And so I think that that glue went together with gluons. But
yes.
I think you must have also had the technical meaning of gluons in mind.
Yes, it's a subatomic particle. I have several subatomic particles on my tiny node chart, but I don't know if I have gluons. I've got baryons, mesons, diquark, and two others. Forget what they are. And I don't have the word gluon. Let me see if I have the word gluon on the tiny node chart. So we'll just finish up with this. Okay, tiny node chart right down here. Just a second. It's not that fast. I thought it would be faster. There it is. Okay, on the tiny node chart, in the top part, I've got, oh, I do, under Rai, which is the Lerouge quadrant, electromagnetism. Under Eloy, which is the McLuhan quadrant, I have gluon. Under Tu, which is the Thompson quadrant, I have boson. Under Lofty, which is the Crocker quadrant, I have graviton. And then under Bob, I have wormhole slash X particle. That's the five columns that go across the top. Then you have the vertical. And so holopathic radio satellite is the hadron. Holopathic television satellite is the meson. Holopathic computer satellite is the baryon. Holopathic satellite square is the diquark. And there was a new term in the 80s, didn't last long. The anthropomorphic physical is the demon nuclei. So those are the each quadrant is tiny. They're subatomic particles. So the gluon is in there up above on another context. Electromagnetism,
yeah, yeah.
Gluon, boson, graviton, and the X particle. So, yes.
Yeah, so on the next page in the blue text, it says gluons hold the world together. And advertising, McLuhan used to say, was the glue for the industrial age. So there you have glue and gluon brought together.
Yeah.
But on the tiny note chart, you have the gluons in the context of all of the subatomic particles.
Yeah.
And so at some point, the relationship of the subatomic particles needs to be considered.
Yeah. That is the... I try to take concepts from every discipline, and so that is the quantum science terms for the holopathic, for the tiny. Because remember, the left column, it's called a holopathic radio slash satellite, and then I put a complementary subatomic particle to match that. And I think I looked them up and figured out what was the closest to each particular media. So, yeah, I have on page 151, the glue for the industrial age is the quote I say, McLuhan, but what you said was maybe more accurate. What did you say? Advertising is the glue?
Yeah, I was just reading your quote.
Okay, the glue for the industrial, oh, yeah. Advertising is the glue for the industrial age, yeah. So I do a pun on glue.
The quote from McLuhan that... was quoted by you.
Yeah.
So I was quoting you, quoting McLuhan.
And I don't think that's actually what he says anywhere.
Well, I'd have to look that up.
Yeah. If you can find it, that'd be good to have the reference point. But the what are we saying here? Yeah, we have to understand how the glue is the Gutenberg connecting thing, which people think we need, but the actual connecting is the resonant interval of the non-connected parts of matter or the non-connected media matings.
Well, the thing is, glue can be used in various ways. So if it's taken as a sort of a natural substance, then it's a Gutenberg galaxy phrase, but if it's taken as a subatomic particle, then it's electric.
Yeah.
And I ran glue for the industrial age, and it doesn't come up in anything.
Okay, yeah. See, I put it in quotes, but didn't give any footnote to what it was.
Yeah.
But for somehow, he must have said that at one class, you know?
Sure.
In the conference.
Oh, it sounds like him.
Yeah. So we're at, make a note of this, we just did, okay, what, 150 we're on?
100, well, yeah, we actually went on 151 and then came back.
Right, so we are at the...
We can start at the bottom of 150 if you think that would be right.
Yeah, I did the commentary, Jock the Beneath,
we did that. Yeah.
So we will do...
So start up in the middle of 151?
Yeah, maybe we'll redo my commentary and then get into the messages, man is still the content, and the glue for industrial age, and then we end up with gluons as a particle, and then maybe we'll talk about that. Or we'll just go to the next part. I'm not sure, because we already read that. But, you know, you want more talk about the subatomic particles on the tiny note chart. So this next part, I'm starting to get into the bodies here. So we'll see how it goes. You know, it'll be 2 or 3 weeks from now, and things have changed or not. And we'll see what we're inspired, what we need to repeat here.
Good, good.
All right. So great work there. Not more. We keep moving ahead. Some kind of refinement's going on here.
Yeah, I think we're beginning to discern some delineation of the tech body, which is the object of the thing.
Yeah, we've retraced the stages, and it's working.
Good.
You know, we're getting to see what this thing is after the Android meme.
Yes, sir.
And the memes are colloquial now. All the kids talk about memes. So that's the Android meme as an old environment.
Yeah.
Okay, man.
They've become homeopathic.
Yes. Yeah. And I laid that out in my 1987 memo to Prince Charles, where we all become homeopathic environments on the co-anesthetic level. And it's hard to put a social hierarchy on that. And all the institutions want to preserve that Gutenberg hierarchy, and the kids know more than you. But they don't know how they got there. And
right.
The parents don't know how to explain how they got there, so where are the parents, you and I?
Yeah.
We are describing how you, as McLuhan says to those kids in that CBC broadcast in 69, I'm explaining how you got into your shape. He says, how the shape you got in. Do you remember that line?
Vaguely, yeah.
He says, you don't know how you're in this shape, or you don't know what's putting you in the shape you're in.
Yeah.
That's what we're doing. Describing what put you into this particular shape of homeopathic cliche probing.
That's right. And meanwhile, the prince has become the king.
The princes, the prince singular or King Charles?
The prince, yeah. You were just talking about your...
Oh, yeah, memo to Prince Charles.
Yeah.
That's right. And there's no prince.
So
there is no kingship there.
You were saying that basically you had seen something in 1988.
87.
Right? And I was saying that the what you saw in 1988... not only was something, it's by becoming the king, it's become everything.
That's right. And, you know, my memory of Prince Charles is me trying to guide him in the McLuhan knowledge so he could be better king. I was consulting to him. That's another story, though. There's a lot about him we know, and that's that. Okay, man, we're cutting it off here.
Okay, good, good, Bob. Thanks.
Okay, thanks a lot, Cameron. Very good.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.